Slave may never be freed. Still, there is the swamp, and there is here. And to us of Suranuani, you of the kingdom are very impatient. Pug knew Kasumi was trying to tell him something. Something perhaps important. For all his openness at times, Kasumi could easily revert to a Surani manner Pug could only call cryptic. There was an unvoiced tension behind Kasumi's words, and Pug thought it best not to press. Changing the topic of conversation again, he asked, "How goes the war, Kasumi?" Kasumi sighed. "Badly for both sides." He watched the grey stallion. "We fight along stable lines, unchanged in the last 3 years. Our last two offences were blunted, but your army also could make no gains. Now weeks pass without fighting. Then your countrymen raid one of our enclaves, and we return the compliment. Little is accomplished except the spilling of blood. It is all very senseless, and there is little honour to be won." Pug was surprised. Everything he had seen of the Surani reinforced Meacham's observation of years ago that the Surani were a very warlike race. Everywhere he had looked when travelling to this estate, he had seen soldiers. Both sons of the house were soldiers, as had been their father in his youth. Hokanu was first-strike leader of his father's garrison, due to his being the lord of the Shinzawe's second son, but his dealing with the slave master at the swamp camp showed a ruthless efficiency in Hokanu, and Pug knew it to be no quirk. He was Surani, and the Surani code was taught at a very early age, and fiercely followed. Kasumi sensed he was being studied and said, "I fear I am becoming softened by your outlandish ways, Pug." He paused. "Come, tell me more of your people, and what..." Kasumi froze. He seized Pug's arm and cocked his head, listening. After a brief instant, he said, "No, it can't be." Suddenly he wheeled and shouted, "Raid! The Thune!" Pug listened and in the distance could hear the faint rumbling as if a herd of horses were galloping over the plains. He climbed upon the rail of the corral and looked into the distance. A large meadow stretched away behind the corral, ending at the edge of a lightly wooded area. While the alarm sounded behind him, he could see forms emerging from the tree line. Pug watched in terrible fascination as the creatures called Thune came racing toward the estate house. They grew in stature as they ran furiously toward where Pug waited. They were large, centaur-like beings, looking like mounted riders in the distance. Rather than horse-like, the lower body was reminiscent of a large deer or an elk, but more heavily muscled. The upper body was completely man-like, but the face resembled nothing so much as an ape with a long snout. The entire body, except the face, was covered by a medium-length fur, mottled grey and white. Each creature carried a club or axe, the head being stone lashed to the wooden haft. Hokanu and the household guard came running from the soldiers' building and took up positions near the corral. Archers readied their bows, and swordsmen stood in ranks, ready to accept the charge. Suddenly, Lorry was at Pug's side, holding his nearly finished loot.
"What? Thune raid?"
Lorry stood as fascinated by the sight as Pug. Suddenly he put his loot aside, then jumped into the corral.
"What do you think you're doing?"
yelled Pug. The troubadour dodged a protective feint by the grey stallion and jumped upon the back of another horse, the dominant mare of the small herd.
"Trying to get the animal safely away."
Pug nodded and opened the gate. Lorry rode the horse out, but the grey kept the others from following, herding them back. Pug hesitated for a minute, then said,
"Algon, I hope you knew what you taught."
He walked calmly toward the stallion, silently trying to convey a sense of command. When the stallion put back his ears and snorted at him, Pug said, "Stand!" The horse's ears cocked at the command, and it seemed to be deciding. Pug knew timing was critical and did not break the rhythm of his approach. The horse studied him as he came alongside, and Pug said, "Stand!" again. Then before the animal could bolt, he grabbed a handful of mane and was up on its back. The battle-trained warhorse, whether by design or luck, decided Pug was close enough to his former master to respond. Perhaps it was due to the clamor of battle around, but for whatever reason, the grey leaped forward in response to Pug's leg commands and was out the gate at a run. Pug gripped with his legs for his life. As the horse cleared the gate, Pug shouted, "Lorry, get the others!" as the stallion turned to the left. Pug glanced over his shoulder and saw the other animals following the herd leader as Lorry brought her past the gate. Pug saw Kasumi running from the tack house, a saddle in his hand, and shouted, "Whoa!" setting as hard a seat as he could manage bareback. The stallion halted, and Pug commanded, "Stand!" The grey pawed the ground in anticipation of a fight. Kasumi shouted as he approached, "Keep the horses from fighting! This is a blood raid, and the Thun will not retreat until each has killed at least once." He called for Lorry to stop, and when the small herd was milling about, he quickly saddled a horse and turned it away from the others. Pug kicked, and the grey and the mare Lorry rode led the remaining four horses to the side of the estate house. They kept the animals closely bunched out of sight of the attacking Thun. A soldier came running around the corner of the house, carrying weapons. He reached Pug and Lorry and shouted, "My master Kasumi commands you defend the horses with your lives." He handed the two slaves each a sword and shield, then turned and dashed back toward the fighting. Pug regarded the strange sword and shield, lighter by half than any he had ever trained with. A shrill cry interrupted his examination as Kasumi came riding around the house in a running fight with a Thun warrior. The eldest son of the Shinzawe rode well, and though he had little training in fighting from horseback, he was a skilled swordsman. His inexperience was offset by the Thun's lack of experience with horses, for while it was not unlike fighting one of his own kind, the horse was also attacking, biting at the creature's chest and face. Catching wind of the Thun, Pug's grey reared and nearly threw him. He held fiercely to the mane and gripped tightly with his lower legs. The other horses neighed, and Pug fought to keep his from charging. Lorry shouted, "They don't like the way those things smell. Look at the way Kasumi's horse is acting." Another of the creatures came into sight, and Lorry let out a whoop and rode to intercept. They came together in a clash of weapons, and Lorry took the Thun club blow on his shield. His own sword struck the creature across the chest, and it cried out in a strange guttural language, staggering for a moment, then falling. Pug heard a scream from inside the house and turned to see one of the thin sliding doors erupt outward as a body hurled through it. A stunned house slave staggered to his feet, then collapsed, blood welling up from a wound on his head. Other figures came scurrying through the door. Pug saw Katala and Almarella running from the house with the others, a Thun warrior in pursuit. The creature bore down upon Katala, club raised high overhead. Pug shouted her name, and the grey sensed his rider's alarm. Without command, the huge warhorse sprang forward, intercepting the Thun as it closed with the slave girl. The horse was enraged from the sounds of battle or the Thun smell. It crashed heavily into the Thun, biting and lashing out with heavy forelegs, and the Thun's legs went out from under it. Pug was thrown by the impact and landed heavily. He lay dazed for a moment. Then he climbed to his feet. He staggered to where Katala sat huddled and pulled her away from the maddened stallion. The grey reared above the still Thun, and hooves came flashing down. Again and again the warhorse struck at the Thune, until there was no doubt of there being a breath of life left in the fallen creature. Pug shouted for the horse to halt and stand, and with a contemptuous snort, the animal ceased the attack, but it kept its ears pinned back, and Pug could see it quiver. Pug approached it and stroked its neck, until the animal stopped trembling. Then it was quiet. Pug looked about and saw Lorry riding after the scattering horses. He left his own mount and returned to Katala. She sat trembling upon the grass, Almarella at her side. Kneeling before her, he said, "Are you all right?" She took a deep breath, then gave him a frightened smile. "Yes, but I was sure I was going to be trampled for a minute." Pug looked at the slave girl who had come to mean so much to him and said, "I thought so too." Suddenly they were both smiling at each other. Almarella stood and made some comment about seeing to the others. "I was so afraid you'd been hurt," Pug said. "I thought I would lose my mind when I saw you running from that creature." Katala put her hand upon Pug's cheek, and he realized they were wet with tears. "I was so frightened for you," he said. "And I for you. I thought you'd be killed the way you came crashing into the Thune." Then she was weeping. She came slowly into his arms. "I don't know what I would do if you were killed." Pug gripped her with all his strength. They sat that way for a few minutes, until Katala regained her composure. Gently pulling away from Pug, she said, "The estate is a shambles. Septian will have 1,000 things for us to do." She began to stand, and Pug gripped her hand. Rising before her, he said, "I didn't know before, I mean. I love you, Katala." She smiled at him, touching his cheek. "And I you, Pug." Their moment of discovery was interrupted by the appearance of the Lord of the Shinzawe and his younger son. Looking around, he surveyed the damage to his house as Kasumi rode around the corner, splattered in blood. Kasumi saluted his father and said, "They have fled. I have ordered men dispatched to the northern watch forts. They must have overwhelmed one of the garrisons to have broken through." The Lord of the Shinzawe nodded he understood and turned to enter his house, calling for his first advisor and his other senior servants to report the damage to him. Katala whispered to Pug, "We'll talk later," and answered the hoarse shouts of the Hadonra Septium. Pug joined Lorry, who had ridden up to Kasumi's side. The minstrel looked at the dead creatures on the ground and said, "What are they?" Kasumi said, "Thune. They're nomadic creatures of the northern tundra. We have forts along the foothills of the mountains separating our estates from their lands at every pass. Once they roamed these ranges until we drove them north. Occasionally they seek to return to the warmer lands of the south." He pointed to a talisman tied in the fur of one of the creatures. "This was a blood raid. They are all young males, unproved in their bands, without mates. They failed in the summer rites of combat and were banished from the herd by the stronger males. They had to come south, killing at least one Surani before they would be allowed to return to their band. Each would have to return with a Surani head, or not come back. It is their custom. Those who escaped will be hunted down, but they will not cross back to their home range." Lorry shook his head. "Does this happen often?"
"Every year," said Hokanu with a wry smile. "Usually the watch forts turn them back, but it must have been a large herd this year. Many must have already returned to the north with heads taken from our men at the forts."
Kasumi said, "They must have killed 2 patrols as well." He shook his head. "We've lost between 60 and 100 men." Hokanu seemed to reflect his older brother's unhappiness at the setback. "I will personally lead a patrol to see to the damage."
Kasumi gave him permission, and he left. Kasumi turned toward Lorry.
The horses?
Lorry pointed to where the stallion Pug had ridden stood watch over a small herd. Suddenly, Pug spoke up.
Kasumi, I do wish to ask your father permission to marry Katala.
Kasumi's eyes narrowed.
Listen well, Pug. I tried to instruct you, but you did not seem to catch my meaning. You are not of a subtle people. Now I will put it plainly. You may ask, but it will be refused.
Pug began to object, but Kasumi cut him off.
I have said you are impatient people. There are reasons. More I cannot say, but there are reasons, Pug.
Anger flared in Pug's eyes, and Kasumi said, in the king's tongue,
Say a word in anger within earshot of any soldier of this house, especially my brother, and you are a dead slave.
Stiffly, Pug said, Your will, master. Witnessing the bitterness of Pug's expression, Kasumi softly repeated,
There are reasons, Pug.
For a moment he was trying to be other than a Surani master, a friend trying to ease pain. He locked gaze with Pug, then a veil dropped over Kasumi's eyes, and once more they were slave and master. Pug lowered his eyes, as was expected of a slave, and Kasumi said,
See to the horses.
He strode away, leaving Pug alone. Pug never spoke of his request to Katala. She sensed that something troubled him deeply, something that seemed to add a bitter note to their otherwise joyful time together. He learned the depth of his love for her and began to explore her complex nature. Besides being strong-willed, she was quick-minded. He only had to explain something to her once, and she understood. He learned to love her dry wit, a quality native to her people, the Turil, and sharpened to a razor's edge by her captivity. She was an observant student of everything around her, and commented unmercifully upon the foibles of everyone in the household, to their detriment and Pug's amusement. She insisted upon learning some of Pug's language, so he began teaching her the king's tongue. She proved an apt student. 2 months went by uneventfully. Then one night, Pug and Lorry were called to the dining room of the master of the house. Lorry had completed work upon his lute and, though dissatisfied in 100 little ways, judged it passable for playing. Tonight he was to play for the Lord of the Shinzawe. They entered the room and saw that the Lord was entertaining a guest, a black-robed man, the Great One whom they had glimpsed months ago. Pug stood by the door, while Lorry took a place at the foot of the low dining table. Adjusting the cushion he sat upon, he began to play. As the first notes hung in the air, he started singing, an old tune that Pug knew well. It sang of the joys of harvest and the riches of the land, and was a favorite in farm villages throughout the kingdom. Besides Pug, only Kasumi understood the words, though his father could pick out a few that he had learned during his chess matches with Pug. Pug had never heard Lorry sing before, and he was genuinely impressed. For all the troubadour's braggadocio, he was better than any Pug had heard. His voice was a clear, true instrument, expressive in both words and music of what he sang. When he was finished, the diners politely struck the table with eating knives, in what Pug assumed was the Surani equivalent of applause. Lorry began another tune, a merry air played at festivals throughout the kingdom. Pug remembered when he had last heard it, at the festival of Benapis, the year before he had left Cridy for Rillanon. He could almost see once more the familiar sights of home. For the first time in years, Pug felt a deep sadness and longing that nearly overwhelmed him. Pug swallowed hard, easing the tightness in his throat. Homesickness and hopeless frustration warred within him, and he could feel his hard-learned self-control slipping away. He quickly invoked one of the calming exercises he had been taught by Colgan. A sense of well-being swept over him, and he relaxed. While Laurie performed, Pug used all his concentration to fend off the haunting memories of home. All his skills created an aura of calm he could stand within, a refuge from useless rage, the only legacy of reminiscence. Several times during the performance, Pug felt the gaze of the Great One upon him. The man seemed to study him with some question in his eyes. When Laurie was finished, the magician leaned over and spoke to his host. The Lord of the Shinzawe beckoned Pug to the table. When he was seated, the Great One spoke.
"I must ask you something."
His voice was clear and strong, and his tone reminded Pug of Colgan when he was preparing Pug for lessons.
"Who are you?"
The direct, simple question caught everyone at the table by surprise. The Lord of the House seemed uncertain as to the magician's question and started to reply.
"He is a slave."
He was interrupted by the Great One's upraised hand. Pug said,
"I am called Pug, Master."
Again, the man's dark eyes studied him.
"Who are you?"
Pug felt flustered. He had never liked being the center of attention, and this time it was focused upon him as never before in his life.
"I am Pug, once of the Duke of Crydee's court."
"Who are you to stand here radiating the power?"
At this, all three men of the Shinzawe household started, and Laurie looked at Pug in confusion.
"I am a slave, Master."
"Give me your hand."
Pug reached out, and his hand was taken by the Great One. The man's lips moved, and his eyes clouded over. Pug felt a warmth flow through his hand and over him. The room seemed to glow with a soft white haze. Soon all he could see was the magician's eyes. His mind fogged over, and time was suspended. He felt a pressure inside his head, as if something were trying to intrude. He fought against it, and the pressure withdrew. His vision cleared, and the two dark eyes seemed to withdraw from his face until he could see the entire room again. The magician let go of his hand.
"Who are you?"
A brief flicker in his eyes was the only sign of his deep concern.
"I am Pug, apprentice to the magician Colgan."
At this, the Lord of the Shinzawe blanched, confusion registering on his face.
"How?"
The black-robed Great One rose and announced,
"This slave is no longer property of this house. He is now the province of the Assembly."
The room fell silent. Pug couldn't understand what was happening and felt afraid. The magician drew forth a device from his robe. Pug remembered that he had seen one before, during the raid on the Surani camp, and his fear mounted. The magician activated it, and it buzzed as the other one had. He placed his hand on Pug's shoulder, and the room disappeared in a gray haze. Chapter 3. Changeling. The elf prince sat quietly. Kaelin awaited his mother. There was much on his mind, and he needed to speak with her this night. There had been little chance for that of late, for as the war had grown in scope, he found less time to abide in the bowers of Elvander. As war leader of the elves, he had been in the field nearly every day since the last time the outworlders had tried to forge across the river. Since the siege of Castle Crydy 3 years before, the outworlders had come each spring, swarming across the river like ants, a dozen for each elf. Each year, elven magic had defeated them. Hundreds would enter the sleeping glades to fall into the endless sleep, their bodies being consumed by the soil to nourish the magic trees. Others would answer the dryad's call, following the enchanted sprites' songs until, in their passion for the elemental beings, they would die of thirst while still in their inhuman lover's embrace, feeding the dryads with their lives. Others would fall to the creatures of the forests, the giant wolves, bears, and lions, who answered the call of the elven warhorns. The very branches and roots of the trees of the elven forests would resist the invaders until they turned and fled. But this year, for the first time, the black robes had come. Much of the elven magic had been blunted. The elves had prevailed. But Kaelin wondered how they would fare when the outworlders returned. This year, the dwarves of the Grey Towers had again aided the elves. With the Moradhel gone from the Green Heart, the dwarves had made swift passage from their wintering in the mountains, adding their numbers to the defense of Elvander. For the third year since the siege at Crydy, the dwarves had proved the difference in holding the outworlders across the river. And again with the dwarves came the man called Thomas. Kaelin looked up, then rose as his mother approached. Queen Aglarana seated herself upon her throne and said, "My son, it is good to see you again." "Mother, it is good to see you also." He sat at her feet and waited for the words he needed to come. His mother sat patiently, sensing his dark mood. Finally he spoke, "I am troubled by Thomas."
"As am I," said the queen, her expression clouded and pensive.
"Is that why you absent yourself when he comes to court?"
"For that, and other reasons."
"How can it be the Old One's magic still holds so strong after all these ages?"
A voice came from behind the throne. "So that's it, then?" They turned, surprised, and Dolgan stepped from the gloom, lighting his pipe. Aglarana looked incensed.
"Are the dwarves of the Grey Towers known for eavesdropping, Dolgan?"
The dwarven chief ignored the bite of the question.
"Usually not, my lady, but I was out for a walk. Those little tree rooms fill with smoke right quickly, and I happened to overhear. I did not wish to interrupt."
Kaelin said,
"You can move with stealth when you choose, friend Dolgan."
Dolgan shrugged and blew a cloud of smoke.
"Elven folk are not the only ones with the knack of treading lightly. But we were speaking of the lad. If what you say is true, then it is a serious matter indeed. Had I known, I would never have allowed him to take the gift."
The queen smiled at him.
"It is not your fault, Dolgan. You could not have known. I have feared this since Thomas came among us in the mantle of the Old Ones. At first I thought the magic of the Valhuru would not work for him, being a mortal, but now I can see he is less mortal each year. It was an unfortunate series of events brought this to pass. Our spell weavers would have discovered that treasure ages ago, but for the dragon's magic. We spent centuries seeking out and destroying such relics, preventing their use by the Moradhel. Now it is too late, for Thomas would never willingly let the armor be destroyed."
Dolgan puffed at his pipe.
"Each winter he broods in the long halls, awaiting the coming of spring and the coming of battle. There is little else for him. He sits and drinks, or stands at the door staring out into the snow, seeing what no other can see. He keeps the armor locked away in his room during such times, and when campaigning he never removes it, even to sleep.
He has changed, and it is not a natural changing. No, he would never willingly give up the armor.
We could try to force him, said the queen, but that could prove unwise. There is something coming into being in him, something that may save my people, and I would risk much for them.
Dolgan said,
I do not understand, my lady.
I am not sure I do either, Dolgan, but I am queen of a people at war. A terrible foe savages our lands, and each year grows bolder. The outworld magic is strong, perhaps stronger than any since the old ones vanished. It may be the magic and the dragon's gift will save my people.
Dolgan shook his head.
It seems strange such power could still reside in metal armor.
Aglarana smiled at the dwarf.
Does it? What of the hammer of Tholin you carry? Is it not vested with powers from ages past? Powers that mark you once more heir to the throne of the dwarves of the West?
Dolgan looked hard at the queen.
You know much of our ways, lady. I must never forget your girlish countenance masks ages of knowledge.
He then brushed away her comment.
We have been done with kings for many years in the West, since Tholin vanished in the Mac Mordain Cadal. We do as well as those who obey old King Halfdan in Dorgin. But should my people wish the throne restored, we shall meet in Moot, though not until this war is over. Now, what of the lad?
Aglarana looked troubled.
He is becoming what he is becoming. We can aid that transformation. Our spellweavers work to this end already. Should the full power of the Val Horu rise up in Thomas untempered, he would be able to brush aside our protective magic much as you would a bothersome twig barring your way upon the trail. But he is not an old one born. His nature is as alien to the Val Haru as their nature was to all others. Aided by our spellweavers, his human ability to love, to know compassion, to understand, may temper the unchecked power of the Val Haru. If so, he may prove a boon to us all.
Dolgan was visited by the certainty the queen had been about to say something else, but remained silent as she continued.
Should that Val Haru power become coupled with a human's capacity for blind hatred, savagery, and cruelty, then he would become something to fear. Only time will tell us what such a blending will produce.
The Dragon Lords, said Dolgan.
We have some mention of the Val Haru in our lore, but only scraps here and there. I would understand more, if you'll permit.
The queen looked off into the distance.
Our lore, eldest of all in the world today, tells of the Val Haru, Dolgan. There is much of which I am forbidden to speak, names of power, fearful to invoke, things terrible to recall, but I may tell you this much. Long before man or dwarf came to this world, the Val Haru ruled. They were part of this world, fashioned from the very fabric of its creation, nearly godlike in power and unfathomable in purpose. Their nature was chaotic and unpredictable. They were more powerful than any others. Upon the backs of the great dragons they flew, no place in the universe beyond their reach. To other worlds they roamed, bringing back that which pleased them, treasure and knowledge plundered from other beings. They were subject to no law but their own will and whim. They fought among themselves as often as not, and only death resolved conflicts. This world was their dominion, and we were their creatures. We and the Moradhel were of one race then, and the Val Haru bred us as you would cattle. Some were taken from both races for personal pets, bred for beauty and other qualities. Others were bred to tend the forests and fields, Those who lived in the wild became the forerunners of the elves, while those who remained with the Valhuru were the forerunners of the Moradhel. But then came a time of changing. Our masters ceased their internecine struggles and banded together. Why they did so is forgotten, though some among the Moradhel may still know, for they were closer to our masters than we elves. We may have known their reasons then, but this was the time of the Chaos Wars, and much was lost. Only this we know. All the servants of the Valhuru were given freedom, and the old ones were never again seen by Elf or Moradhel. When the Chaos Wars raged, great rifts in time and space were opened, and it was through these that goblins, men, and dwarves came to this world. Few of our people or of the Moradhel survived, but those that did rebuilt our homes. The Moradhel longed to inherit the might of their lost masters rather than seek their own destiny as the elves did, and use their cunning to find tokens of the Valhuru, taking to the dark path. It is the reason we are so unlike, who once were brothers. The old magic is still powerful. In strength and bravery, Thomas matches any. He took the magic unwittingly, and that may prove the difference. The old magic changed the Moradhel into the Brotherhood of the Dark Path, because they sought the power out of dark longings. Thomas was a boy of good and noble heart, with no taint of evil in his soul. Perchance he will grow to master the dark side of the magic. Dolgan scratched his head. "'Tis a grave risk, then, from what you say. I was concerned for the lad, true, and gave little thought to the larger scheme of things. You know the way of it better than I, but I hope we'll not live to regret letting him keep the armor." The queen stepped down from her throne. "I also hope there will be no regrets, Dolgan. Here in Elvander, the old magic is softened, and Thomas is of lighter heart. Perhaps that is a sign we do the right thing, tempering the change rather than opposing it." Dolgan made a courtly bow. "I yield to your wisdom, my lady, and I pray you are right." The queen bade them good night and left. Cailin said, "I also pray my mother queen speaks from wisdom, and not from some other feeling." "I don't take your meaning, elf prince." Cailin looked down upon the short figure. "Don't play the fool with me, Dolgan. Your wisdom is widely known and highly respected. You see it as well as I. Between my mother and Thomas, there is something growing." Dolgan sighed, the freshening breeze carrying away his pipe's smoke. "Aye, Cailin, I've seen it as well. A look, little more, but enough. She looks upon Thomas as she once looked upon my father, King, though she still denies it within herself." "And there is something within Thomas," said the dwarf, watching the elf prince closely, "though it is less tender than what your lady feels. Still, he holds it well in check." "Look to your friend, Dolgan. Should he try to press his suit for the queen, there will be trouble." "So much do you dislike him, Cailin?" Cailin looked thoughtfully at Dolgan. "No, Dolgan, I do not dislike Thomas. I fear him. That is enough." Cailin was silent for a while, then said, "We will never again bend knee before another master, we who live in Elvander. Should my mother's hopes of how Thomas will change prove false, we shall have a reckoning." Dolgan shook his head slowly. "That would prove a sorry day, Cailin." "That it would, Dolgan." Cailin walked from the council ring, past his mother's throne, and left the dwarf alone. Dolgan looked out at the fairy lights of Elvander, praying the elf queen's hopes would not prove unfounded.
Winds howled across the plains. Ash and Sugar sat astride the broad shoulders of Shuriga. The great golden dragon's thoughts reached his master.
Do we hunt?
There was hunger in the dragon's mind.
No, we wait.
The ruler of the eagle's reaches waited as the streaming Moridhel made their way toward the rising city. Hundreds pulled great blocks of stone mined in quarries half a world away, dragging them toward the city on the plains. Many had died, and many more would die, but that was unimportant.
Or was it?
Ash and Sugar was troubled by this new and strange thought. A roar from above sounded as another great dragon came spiraling down, a magnificent black bellowing challenge. Shuriga raised his head and trumpeted his reply. To his master he said,
Do we fight?
No.
Ash and Sugar sensed disappointment in his mount, but chose to ignore it. He watched as the other dragon settled gracefully to the ground a short distance away, folding its mighty wings across its back. Black scales reflected the hazy sunlight like polished ebony. The dragon's rider raised his hand in salute. Ash and Sugar returned the greeting, and the other's dragon approached cautiously. Shuriga hissed, and Ash and Sugar absently struck the beast with his fist. Shuriga lapsed into silence.
Has the ruler of the eagle's reaches finally come to join us?
Asked the newcomer, Draken Corrin, the Lord of Tigers. His black and orange-striped armor sparkled as he dismounted from his dragon. Out of courtesy, Ash and Sugar dismounted as well. His hand never strayed far from his white-hilted sword of gold, for though times were changing, trust was unknown among the Valharu. In times past, they would have fought as likely as not, but now the need for information was more pressing. Ash and Sugar said,
No. I simply watch.
Draken Corrin regarded the ruler of the eagle's reaches, his pale blue eyes revealing no emotion.
You alone have not agreed, Ashen Sugar. Joining to plunder across the cosmos is one thing, Draken Corrin. This plan of yours is madness.
What is this madness? I know not of what you speak.
We are. We do. What more is there? This is not our way.
It is not our way to let others stand against our will.
These new beings, they contest with us.
Ash and Sugar raised his eyes skyward.
Yes, that is so, but they are not like others. They also are formed from the very stuff of this world, as are we.
What does that matter? How many of our kin have you killed? How much blood has passed your lips? Whoever stands against you must be killed or kill you. That is all.
What of those left behind, the Moridhel and the elves?
What of them? They are nothing.
They are ours.
You have grown strange under your mountains, Ash and Sugar.
They are our servants. It is not as if they possessed true power. They exist for our pleasure, nothing more. What concerns you?
I do not know. There is something.
Thomas? For an instant, Thomas existed in two places. He shook his head and the visions vanished. He turned his head and saw Ghislaine lying in the brush next to him. A force of elves and dwarves waited some distance behind. The young cousin of Prince Kaelin pointed toward the Surani camp across the river. Thomas followed his companion's gesture and saw the outworld soldiers sitting near their campfires and smiled.
They hugged their camps,
he whispered. Ghislaine nodded.
We have strung them enough that they seek the warmth of their campfires.
The late spring evening mist shrouded the area, mantling the Surani camp in haze. Even the campfires seemed to burn less brightly. Thomas again studied the camp, I mark 30, with 30 more in each camp, east and west.
Ghislaine said nothing, waiting for Thomas's next command. Though Cailin was war leader of Elvander, Thomas had assumed command of the forces of elves and dwarves. It was never clear when captaincy had passed to him, but slowly, as he had grown in stature, he had grown in leadership. In battle, he would simply shout for something to be done, and elves and dwarves would rush to obey. At first, it had been because the commands were logical and obvious, but the pattern had become accepted, and now they obeyed because it was Thomas who commanded. Thomas motioned for Ghislaine to follow and moved away from the riverbank, until they were safely out of sight of the Serrani camp, among those who waited deep within the trees. Dolgan looked at the young man who once had been the boy he saved from the mines of Mac Mordane Cadal. Thomas stood 6 inches past 6 feet in height, as tall as any elf. He walked with a powerful self-assurance, a warrior born. In the 6 years he had been with the dwarves, he had become a man, and more. Dolgan watched him as Thomas surveyed the warriors gathered before him, and knew Thomas could now walk the dark mines of the Grey Towers without fear or danger. "Have the other scouts returned?" Dolgan nodded, signaling for them to come forward. 3 elves and 3 dwarves approached. "Any sign of the black robes?" When the scouts indicated no, the man in white and gold frowned. "We would do well to capture one of them and carry him to Elvander. Their last attack was the deepest yet. I would give much to know the limits of their power." Dolgan took out his pipe, gauging they were far enough from the river for it not to be seen. As he lit it, he said, "The Serrani guard the black robes like a dragon guards its treasure." Thomas laughed at that, and Dolgan caught a glimpse of the boy he had known. "Aye, and it's a brave dwarf who loots a dragon's lair." Ghislaine said, "If they follow the pattern of the last 3 years, they most likely are done with us for the season. It is possible we shall not see another black robe until next spring." Thomas looked thoughtful, his pale eyes seemingly aglow with a light of their own. Their pattern is to take, to hold, then to take more. We have been willing to let them do as they wish, so long as they do not cross the river. It is time to change that pattern. And if we trouble them enough, we may have the opportunity to seize one of these black robes." Dolgan shook his head at the risk implicit in what Thomas proposed. Then, with a smile, Thomas added, "Besides, if we can't loosen their hold along the river for a time, the dwarves and I will be forced to winter here, for the outworlders are now deep into the Green Heart." Ghislaine looked at his tall friend. Thomas grew more elf-like each year, and Ghislaine could appreciate the obscure humor that often marked his words. He knew Thomas would welcome staying near the Queen, but in spite of his worries over Thomas's magic, he had come to like the man. "How?" "Send bowmen to the camps on the right and the left and beyond. When I call with the honk of a grey lag, have them volley across the river. But from beyond those positions, as if the main attack were coming from east and west." He smiled, and there was no humor in his expression. "That should isolate this camp long enough for us to do some bloody work." Ghislaine nodded and sent 10 bowmen to each camp. The others made ready for the attack, and after sufficient time, Thomas raised his hands to his mouth. Cupping them, he made the sound of a wild goose. A moment later, he could hear shouting coming from east and west of the position across the river. The soldiers in the Serrani camp stood and looked both ways, with several coming to the edge of the water, peering into the dark forest. Thomas raised his hand and dropped it with a chopping motion. Suddenly it was raining elven arrows on the camp across the river, and Serrani soldiers were diving for their shields.
Before they could fully recover, Thomas led a charge of dwarves across the shallow sandbar ford. Another flight of arrows passed overhead. Then the elves shouldered bows, drew swords, and charged after the dwarves, all save a dozen who would stay to offer covering fire should it be needed. Thomas was first ashore and struck down a Surani guard who met him at the river's edge. Quickly he was among them, wreaking mayhem. Surani blood exploded off his golden blade, and the screams of wounded and dying men filled the damp night. Dolgan slew a guard and found none to stand against him. He turned and saw Ghislain standing over another dead Surani, but staring at something beyond. The dwarf followed his gaze to where Thomas was standing over a wounded Surani soldier who lay with blood running down his face from a scalp wound, an arm upraised in a plea for mercy. Over him stood Thomas, his face an alien mask of rage. With a strange and terrible cry, in a voice cruel and harsh, he brought down his golden sword and ended the Surani's life. He turned quickly, seeking more foes. When none presented themselves, he seemed to go blank for a moment. Then his eyes refocused. Ghislain heard a dwarf call, "They come!" Shouts came from the other Surani camps as they discovered the ruse and quickly approached the true battle site. Without a word, Thomas's party hurried across the water. They reached the other side as Surani bowmen fired upon them, to be answered by elves on the opposite shore. The attacking group quickly fell back deeply into the trees until they were a safe distance away. When they stopped, the elves and dwarves sat down to catch their wind and to rest from the battle surge still in their blood. Ghislain looked to Thomas and said, "We did well. No one lost, and only a few slightly wounded, and 30 outworlders slain." Thomas didn't smile, but looked thoughtfully for a moment, as if hearing something. He turned to look at Ghislain, as if the elf's words were finally registering. "Aye, we did well, but we must strike again, tomorrow and the next day and the next, until they act." Night after night they crossed the river. They would attack a camp, and the next night strike miles away. A night would pass without attack. Then the same camp would be raided 3 nights running. Sometimes a single arrow would take a guard from the opposite shore, then nothing, while his companions stood waiting for an attack that never came. Once they struck through the lines at dawn, after the defenders had decided that no attack was coming. They overran a camp, ranging miles into the South Forest, and took a baggage train, even slaughtering the strange 6-legged beasts who pulled the wagons. 5 separate fights were fought as they turned from that raid, and 2 dwarves and 3 elves were lost. Now Thomas and his band, numbering over 300 elves and dwarves, sat awaiting word from other camps. They were eating a stew of venison, seasoned with mosses, roots, and tubers. A runner came up to Thomas and Ghislain. "Word from the king's army." Behind him, a figure in grey approached the campfire. Thomas and Ghislain stood. "Hail, Long Leon of Natal," said the elf.
"Hail, Ghislain," answered the tall, black-skinned ranger.
An elf brought over bread and a bowl of steaming stew to the 2 newcomers, and as they sat, Thomas said, "What news from the duke?" Between mouthfuls of food, the ranger said,
"Lord Boric sends greetings. Things stand poorly. Like moss on a tree, the Surani slowly advance in the east. They take a few yards, then sit. They seem to be in no hurry. The Duke's best guess is they seek to reach the coast by next year, isolating the free cities from the north. Then perhaps an attack towards Zoon or Lamut. Who can say?"
Thomas asked, "Any news from Cridy?"
"Pigeons arrived just before I left. Prince Arutha holds fast against the Surani. They have luck as poor there as here,
but they move southward through the Green Heart. He surveyed the dwarves and Thomas.
I am surprised that you could reach Ilvander.
Dolgan puffed his pipe.
It was a long trek. We had to move swiftly and with stealth. It is unlikely we will be able to return to the mountains now the invaders are aroused. Once in place, they are loath to yield what they have gained.
Thomas paced before the fire.
How did you elude their sentries?
Your raids are causing much confusion in their ranks. Men who faced the armies of the West were pulled out of the line to rush to the river. I simply followed one such group. They never thought to look behind. I had only to slip past their lines when they withdrew and then again across the river.
Kaelin said, How many do they bring against us?
Leon shrugged. I saw 6 companies. There must be others.
They had estimated a Surani company at 20 squads, each of 30 men.
Thomas slapped his gloved hands together.
They would bring 3,000 men back only if they were planning another crossing. They must seek to drive us deep into the forest again, to keep us from harrying their positions.
He crossed a stand over the ranger.
Do any of the black robe ones come?
From time to time, I saw one with the company I followed.
Thomas again slapped his hands.
This time they had come in force. Send word to the other camps. In 2 days' time, all the host of Ilvander is to meet at the Queen's Court, save scouts and runners who will watch the outworlders.
Silently, runners sprang up from the fire and hurried off to carry word to the other elven bands strung out along the banks of the River Cridy.
Ash and Sugar sat upon his throne, oblivious to the dancers. The Moradhel females had been chosen for their beauty and grace, but he was untouched by their allure. His mind's eye was far away, seeking the coming battle. Inside, a strangeness, a hollow feeling without name, came into being.
It is called sadness, said the voice within.
Ash and Sugar thought, Who are you to visit me in my solitude?
I am that which you are becoming. This is but a dream, a memory.
Ash and Sugar drew forth his sword and rose from his throne, bellowing his rage. Instantly the musicians stopped their playing. The dancers, servants, and musicians fell to the floor, prostrating themselves before their master.
I am. There is no dream.
You are but a remembrance of the past, said the voice.
We are becoming one.
Ashen Sugar raised his sword, then lashed down. The head of a cowering servant rolled upon the floor. Ashen Sugar knelt and placed his hand in the fountain of blood. Raising fingers to his lips, he tasted the salty flavor and cried,
Is this not the taste of life?
It is illusion. All has passed.
I feel a strangeness, an unease that makes me... It makes me...
There is no word. It is fear.
Ashen Sugar again lashed out with his sword, and a young dancer died.
These things, they know fear. What has fear to do with me? You are afraid. All creatures fear change, even the gods.
Who are you?
Asked the Valharu silently.
I am you. I am what you will become. I am what you were. I am Thomas.
A shout from below brought Thomas from his reverie. He rose and left his small room, crossing a tree branch bridge to the level of the Queen's Court. At a rail he could make out the dim figures of hundreds of dwarves camped below the heights of Ilvander. He stood for a time watching the campfires below. Each hour hundreds more elven and dwarven warriors made their way to join this army he marshalled. Tomorrow he would sit in council with Kaelin, Tathar, Dolgan, and others, and make known his plan to meet the coming assault. 6 years of fighting had given Thomas a strange counterpoint to the dreams that still troubled his sleep. When the battle rage took him, he existed in another's dreams. When he was away from the elven forest, the call to enter those dreams became ever more difficult to stem. He felt no fear of these visitations, as he had at first. He was more than human because of some long-dead being's dreams. There were powers within him, powers that he could use, and they were now part of him, as they had been part of the wearer of the white and gold. He knew that he would never be Thomas of Cridy again. But what was he becoming? The slightest hint of a footfall sounded behind him. Without turning, he said, "Good eve, my lady." The elf queen came to stand next to him, a studied expression on her face. "Your senses are elven now," she said in her own language. "So it seems, Shining Moon," he answered in the same language, using the ancient translation of her name. He turned to face her and saw wonder in her eyes. She reached out and gently touched his face. "Is this the boy who stood so flustered?